Colleagues, welcome back to the office. It's Steve. Welcome to our podcast for today. This is Critical Tips for Avoiding Identity Theft and Data Breaches, Part 1. Thank you so much for choosing to come for this very important and special podcast where we are going to be examining all the different aspects of identity theft and data breaches in this particular series. In this first episode, we're going to drill directly down into identity theft first, because it's something that can affect all of us personally. And understanding the risks and the implications and all the nasty things that could potentially happen to us will hopefully give us some ideas and some opportunities that we can do to help reduce our risk and exposure. Just being aware of this stuff can be so helpful for not letting it happen to us, and understanding the different things and the signs and the notices and what to be on the lookout for can be very helpful. So in today's course, we're solely going to focus on identity theft. We are going to define what identity or what data breaches are, but we're going to save those for another podcast. In today's class, inside of identity theft, we're going to talk about the individual risks and hazards that present to the individual. And we're also going to talk about a variety of specific types of identity theft, including identity theft as it relates to children, employment, utility, tax, medical, and more. Believe it or not, there's all these really specific types of identity theft that can affect an individual differently. Not all identity theft is just somebody taking your name and, you know, maybe doing a couple fraudulent charges on your credit card. It could be so much worse than just that. And so we'll talk about what some of those specific types are. We're also going to talk significantly about some of the major signs of when identity theft might be occurring. For example, not getting your bills, or people call you that you're not aware of, like bill collectors, and what that means and how to deal with that. Now, in the second part of our course today, we're going to talk about some of the major resources that are there to help mitigate the risk of identity theft. Here in the United States, we have all these incredible resources, from the Federal Trade Commission to the Security and Exchange Commission, and believe it or not, even to the post office. So we'll talk about what some of these resources are and how you can utilize them to help mitigate the effect if you are subject to identity theft. And we'll also talk about some preventative measures you can do. For example, a credit freeze or a fraud alert, things of this nature. And I'm also going to try to pepper in as many best practices and things that I think are very useful to know to help reduce our risk and exposure. So I'll give you as many different best practices as that I can think of throughout our presentation for today. Now, I do want to remind you that if you are a financial professional, and I hope you are, this podcast is eligible for CPE credit. You can earn a credit just by listening to a podcast, and you will be one credit closer to maintaining your license wherever you happen to be. So if you're a CPA, an enrolled agent, certified financial professional, or somewhere else, check it out. You can earn some credits just by listening. It's super simple. Head on over to cpetoday.com, use course code IDT1, and take a short 5-question exam, and you will earn a credit, and you'll be well on your way to maintaining your license. Again, that is cpetoday.com, use course code IDT1 to take today's exam. All right, without further ado, let's just go ahead and dive right into our presentation today. There are so much good and important things that we should be aware of. And what we are going to go ahead and start with is a discussion about what identity theft is and what data breaches are. And I'm going to give you some of the major statistics and facts that I think you should be aware of with respect to these specific issues. So, identity theft, if you kind of look at the macro cause of this in terms of like what it is and the implications to the individual, ultimately it can be distilled down into one word: fraud. The Department of Justice here in the United States, they define identity theft as all types of crime in which somebody frames or deceives for some measure of economic gain. Okay? So ultimately, it's somebody framing or deceiving or otherwise representing themselves as somebody who they are not to another third party. So they will sometimes do this for financial gains. Sometimes it could be direct gains. Sometimes it could be indirect. Sometimes it could be representing themselves as somebody who they're not for employment purposes, or a variety of other things that can come down. Now, ultimately, though, if you present yourself as somebody who you are not, that is identity theft in a nutshell. As I like to think about it, identity theft is really just kind of exploiting somebody else's personal information for personal gain. So things that I might want to exploit would be the name, the reputation, the date of birth, maybe the specific information about that person. So their social security number, their home address, or things of this nature. Often the things that are most personal to us, you know, our identifying personal information, that's not stuff that we can recreate. And if it becomes compromised, there's really not much we can do to get that information out. You know, once it's kind of out in the ether, once it's kind of publicly available, it's publicly available and it will often get reused multiple times. Unfortunately, people who fall victim to identity theft will probably be dealing with this throughout the rest of their lives, because if you get on the list, if you get on the radar, the people who commit these types of heinous acts, unfortunately, you're probably going to have to be dealing with it for a long time because they share information with each other. Now, if you look at identity theft by the numbers, it is by far the fastest growing crime in America. And the fastest growing segment of victims, unfortunately, are children. We'll talk more specifically about child identity theft here in a little bit. But in the course of the entire economy, identity theft outweighs pretty much every major aspect of crime combined. You know, so that would take into account simple stuff, all the way to the more heinous acts that are out there. If you add it all together, there are more people who are being affected by identity theft than all of that. Not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it kind of puts it into perspective, the size, scope, weight, and impact of these crimes. About every minute, 19 new people will fall victim to identity theft. And the victims could range anywhere from just simple, hey, somebody took my credit card and I have to cancel it and reissue it, all the way up to full-blown identity theft where somebody is representing themselves to other people as you. It takes the average victim $500 and about 30 hours to resolve each incidence of identity theft. And what does that mean? Well, often people aren't just dealing with a single thing of identity theft. You know, often, you know, they have to deal and resolve multiple instances because these people will go out and commit multiple crimes, whether they be opening multiple credit accounts or going and working with multiple utilities, or they are presenting themselves to the police or something of that nature. But that takes time and effort to resolve. And on average, it's about $500 and about 30 hours per incident. And so you could think real quick, holy smokes, this could really add up quickly if this were to affect me, because think about all the different organizations, companies, vendors, creditors that you work with. Imagine having to resolve not one, but several of those incidences with each of those companies. Now, only about a third of identity theft cases involve direct financial fraud or credit fraud. There are all these other types of identity theft crimes that can occur, you know, whether it be utilities, like for example, signing up to get gas, electric, water service in somebody else's name. They could be employment fraud where you represent yourself to somebody else, you know, and using their name in order to be able to get a job for one reason or the other, or criminal fraud where somebody, for example, would give their name to the police that in fact is not their name. It is the name of somebody else. And then that person has to deal with whatever crime can occur. Now, identity theft goes often hand in hand, especially in today's environment, with data breaches. And so I'd be remiss if we didn't introduce data breaches in conjunction with what we're talking about here with identity theft, because knowing a little bit about data breaches will help put in context the importance of keeping your data secure and working with good quality providers and reputable providers that are going to host your information. Because guess what? If the companies you work with, the organizations you work with are compromised, that can directly lead to identity theft in your personal life. And so understanding how a data breach occurs will hopefully give you some better insight in choosing different providers and quality providers to either host your companies and organizational data, or if you're making decisions for yourself, like where should I put my email? What cloud provider should I be utilizing? that this will hopefully spur some investigation on your part in terms of the companies that you're choosing to work with. Because a bad decision here can be extremely detrimental, not only to yourself, but to your organization. Now, a data breach occurs when an individual or organization's information systems are penetrated by an unauthorized third party and data is stolen. Now, what does that mean? That means, let's just take, for example, server A, and it's our company's server. Well, a perpetrator, and this could be and often is somebody from around the world. It could be a hacker from Istanbul. It could be a criminal from Eastern Europe. It could be the guy down the street, whoever it ends up being, okay? Well, they will compromise some sort of information system. Information system broadly defined can be anything. It could be your email account. It could be SharePoint. It could be your Microsoft Azure account. It could be AWS. It could be your personal computer. And the way they will do this will be through a variety of mechanisms. And often, frustratingly, the mechanisms, the manner in which that they do this is actually usually quite simple. It's almost always some sort of social engineering, phishing, or if we're getting a little bit more sophisticated, it can be a coordinated DDoS attack or a malware attack or something like that. In our future courses in this specific series, we're going to dive deep into the different methods of penetration and the different methods of data breaches so that you can understand the different ways that these occur and how you can prevent them from happening in your organization. But today, just realize that in some way somebody will break in. And then the data breach is when they exfiltrate the data, when the data itself is actually stolen and then used by some sort of third party for whatever their purposes might be. So the techniques they can use will vary. It could be anything from stealing a password to sending you malware. There are a ton of these different attacks. And honestly, it's like a whack-a-mole game where we figure out one method, we suppress it. You know what? They're going to come up with another. Just imagine if these perpetrators spent their time doing something productive to society, how incredible and what incredible things could come from that. Now, data breaches are horrible for everybody. However, they are particularly horrible for organizations because often they are the custodians of a variety of different types of information. And if they have company information, if they have payroll information, employee information, vendor information, customer information, that could be really bad. And there could be anything from regulatory consequences, legal consequences, civil consequences. And at the very, very minimum, just imagine just having to deal with the reputation damage of having your company be the one that resulted in several people, dozens of people, maybe hundreds, thousands, and even in some instances, hundreds of millions of people having their data stolen or compromised by that third party. And there are a litany and a treasure trove of different organizations that this has happened to. In security, we often say it's not a matter of if you have a data breach, but rather when that data breach might occur. And you could face all sorts of repercussions, beginning with just damaged reputation and ending with bankruptcy and civil or criminal lawsuits, depending on negligence. So, taking data breaches seriously are incredibly important for your organization because the risk is so dramatically high if you are compromised. In a future podcast for this, we are going to dive deep exploring the different types of malware attacks and phishing attacks and social engineering attacks. And I'm going to make it my life's work to give you the tools necessary to be able to combat these horrible acts occurring with you. Now, if we look at data breach by the numbers, okay, an overwhelming number of them are caused by human error or humans in some way being involved, the most common of which are going to be social engineering attacks, where somebody manipulates somebody into willingly handing over information. We've all had this happen. Think about in your life right now, think about this. Have you had somebody call you about an expired car warranty or how your social security number has been compromised or something like that? Unfortunately, a lot of people fall victim to that. And as such, they willingly hand over information that is used against them. And so an overwhelming number of breaches occur by us doing something. Almost 90% of organizations worldwide have experienced some sort of spear phishing attack, which are poignant phishing attacks specifically at executives and people of privilege. Almost 70% of business leaders feel that their cybersecurity risks are increasing, and I'm surprised that number is not higher. Certainly it is not going down. At the organizational level, the average cost of a data breach is approaching $4 million. Think about that for a minute. $4 million. That's the average cost. It goes into the hundreds of millions in instances like the Equifax data breach and other large Fortune 500 companies. The average time to identify a breach, okay, is 207 days. Holy smokes. What that tells us is that if we are breached, we're not going to know about it, and it can go on for a long period of time. And in fact, if we look at some of the major breaches that have occurred in the last couple of years, that's exactly what has happened. Half of us don't know what steps to take in the event of a data breach, and that totally makes sense as well. In future courses, we'll talk about what we can do to rectify this. The average ransomware payment rose a third in 2020, and it's over $100,000 now. And I only expect that to go up in the coming years as well. Smaller organizations, less than 250 employees, are often the ones that are being targeted, not only with email campaigns, but others. You know what? Because they are easy targets. Often small business doesn't have the resources necessary to be able to protect themselves from these attacks occurring. Okay, so who is committing these identity theft and data breach crimes? I mean, who are these people? Now, statistically, if a crime occurs to you, more often than not, it's going to be somebody you know. You know, it's going to be a family member, a colleague, a friend. Unfortunately, even with identity theft, that is still the case. You know, I like to put things in context to the fraud triangle, you know, where people have some sort of issue, some sort of risk of some sort. You know, they have some sort of opportunity to steal, and then some sort of rationalization, you know, for what their actions are, so they can make themselves feel better about the decisions that they've done. And I'm not saying every person that has a life problem, maybe, you know, anything from, you know, for example, a sick family member to something like substance abuse, is going to commit a crime. But it is important to kind of keep that in mind, because they do start to fit a profile. You know, as a auditor, you know, you have to learn profiling. You have to learn the circumstances of what people have, because truthfully, a lot of things do fit patterns. And, you know, identifying these things can at least help you make a decision one way or the other. So be wary of people, you know, who with, you know, anything from substance abuse or a gambling addiction or something like that, because I'm not saying they will do it, but there is an opportunity. There is a chance that they could. So if it's not a family member going through something, or a friend or a colleague, I think they kind of fit into some broad general categories. Strangers with an agenda, imposters and fake people, and just straight up criminals, you know, for whatever, those people are. We've all, for example, gotten, again, the phone call of your car warranty has expired, your social security number has expired. Maybe it's a family member that doesn't sound like the family member calling and saying that they're in jail and need bail money. It could be a rich overseas prince, you know, telling you that they need help getting money out of the country, and they'll cut you in. You know, often they have some sort of agenda. They're trying to manipulate you. They're trying to game you into willingly handing over information to get yourself breached. So be aware of anybody you don't know, a stranger that has some sort of agenda. That's usually a pretty good indication. We have imposters and fake people. They kind of go same hand in hand with this, you know, where somebody will present themselves as a different person, but in fact, they are not that person. They're not your friend Ted. They're not your friend Dan or your friend Sean or whoever it might end up being. Now, in the context of big, large-scale data breaches, we have plenty of straight-up criminal organizations that typically exist outside the United States that treat identity theft and data breaches like a crime. And these vary from small operations with just a couple of people to large-scale, state-sponsored organizations that do this in a very, very large manner, affecting a lot of Western businesses. Now, what I want to remind you is the laws and regulations of the United States start and stop at the borders of the United States. And often these criminal enterprises exist outside the USA. So there's really not much we can do about it if that other country is not willing to enforce. You need to be aware of the fact that the internet is worldwide, and if you can connect to them, they can connect to you. And often these people will be outside of the United States, outside of our jurisdiction, and outside of our ability to be able to hold them accountable. The internet is a wild, wild place. It's the Wild West in some respects. And these criminals know that, and they will use it to their advantage. And in some of these countries, it's not even illegal. In some parts of the world, it's illegal if you compromise or breach a domestic company. But you go ahead and you do that to a company in the United States or in Canada or Great Britain. Guess what? That's not a crime in the context of that local jurisdiction. It would only be domestically. So we need to be aware of this, and we need to make preventative steps just because this is something that so easily can happen, and it can happen in the blink of an eye, and it can go on for a long period of time, affecting a large number of people. Now, what do these criminals do with the information once they have it? Well, I think there are probably three main steps that these criminals will do once they have information that can be used for identity theft or exploited for some sort of economic gain. And I think the first thing that they do is obtain it, then they often will fence it or sell it, and then somebody will purchase it and then ultimately exploit it. Criminals will obtain this information about a target through a number of different methods. It could come from, and often does, from things like phishing campaigns, but it can also be physically obtained too. Dumpster diving, for example, is still very much a thing where people will go through your trash looking for bank statements or anything that might have a social security number or something on it. However, often if it's physically obtained, it's a one-off thing. It's directed at an individual. Phishing or data breaches, those are the really particularly nasty things, and those will typically be pointed at thousands and sometimes millions of potential victims. Now, in the context of large-scale data breaches, the people who obtain the personal information are very rarely the same people who will use it against you. And what I mean by that is one person will essentially compromise you. They will take that information, they will sell it on the dark web, which we'll talk about here in a minute, and then another person will buy it, typically wholesale in bulk, and then will ultimately do their best to either open credit cards or to otherwise fraudulently rip you off in some way or the other. Now, by doing this, this seems like a small distinction. Get the information, sell it, somebody else buys it. This makes it very difficult to be able to track, and it makes it very difficult to be able to prosecute, because finding one criminal is hard enough. Imagine having to find two. It could be very, very difficult in that respect. Ultimately, though, somebody will buy this information. It could be your social security number, your date of birth, your name, your address, and then they will use it to, for example, open a fraudulent credit card, or they'll go get a loan, or increasingly, they'll get things like unemployment benefits. In the rise of the COVID world, unemployment benefit fraud has been rampant here in the United States, with people fraudulently receiving unemployment by pretending to be somebody else. And certainly, tax fraud is increasingly growing as well, where people will take information and then ultimately use it to file a fraudulent tax return. Now, what happens to this data? Where does it ultimately end up? As I mentioned, it ultimately ends up in the dark web. What is the dark web? Well, the dark web is a neighborhood of the internet that you don't want to be caught in after dark. It is where all the illegal stuff occurs. And this is where everything from the purchasing and selling of personal information to narcotics, to steroids, to anything. Well, that's typically where you're going to find it, is in this dark web neighborhood. Don't go looking for this. There's no real benefit to your average Joe in terms of using this. But just know that this is ultimately where this is going to end up being. And it ends up on different sites that will specialize, for example, in identity theft, or there'll be special sites that focus on selling fraudulent credit cards tied to other individuals. And these people are able to conduct their business using this dark web in a fairly anonymous way, where it's not easy and certainly not something that your average person could do in terms of being able to track down these criminals. And typically they do this through a network that we call the Tor network. So if you're interested in learning some more about this, we'll probably do a podcast here in a little bit, specifically looking at the dark web and giving you a sense of not only what in how this could affect you, but also giving you a sense of where and how these criminals are using this, this particular method of networking. Okay, let's go ahead and go into our first review question for the day. Alrighty, which of the following statements about identity theft is not true? Okay, 100% of identity theft victims, let me repeat that again. 100% of identity theft cases involve credit or financial fraud. Well, that is definitely not true. There are many other different types of identity theft that could occur, from utilities to medical to employment to criminal to you name it. So I would say what is not true here, well, not everything involves financial fraud, although a certain large percentage of it does. Okay, next answer. The fastest growing segment of victims are children. That unfortunately is true. More children every year are falling victim to this, and it is a very difficult thing for a lot of parents to resolve. Identity theft is the fastest growing crime in America. That is also true. Every minute, 19 people fall victim to identity theft. That is also true as well. So what is not true? If you think identity theft only involves money, unfortunately, you're going to be mistaken. It can be a lot of different things. Money is just happens to be one of them. All right, for the rest of our presentation for today, let's solely focus on identity theft, and we will dive into data breaches the next time. Both of these are very juicy topics and plenty to discover and learn about. Okay, so what are some general signs of identity theft? What should we be aware of if we start seeing these things occur? Now, if one of these things occur, you could chalk it up to, a weird one-off type thing. You start seeing one or two, three, four of these, that's when you start need to get a little bit serious, and that's when you're going to have to dive in a little bit deeper to determine if you've fallen victim. So one of the easiest ways to identify financial fraud, you see withdrawals from your bank account that you can't explain, or charges on your credit card that you can't explain. And you don't have a teenager that's borrowing your credit card, maybe somebody has compromised this, and that's going to be something you're going to want to look into further. Pro tip, almost every bank will support notifications when charges occur, especially if they're not present with the card itself. American Express, Visa, most banks will have functionality to let you know when certain financial thresholds are hit, like if a charge is over $100 for that matter, or if a credit card was used to purchase something on the internet and the card wasn't physically present. Okay, a great way to mitigate your risk with this is to utilize those notifications from your bank, credit union, or whatever your credit card provider is. You don't get your bills or other mail. Not getting your mail is a really good indication that something bad is afoot. And what I mean by this is often what these criminals will do in large-scale identity theft is they will change the address on the account. And in doing so, they're going to be able to conceal their fraud a lot longer. So if you're used to getting physical mail and you don't get physical mail, be aware that that could be an issue. Two things I will tell you. First and foremost, as much as possible, switch stuff to online billing, switch stuff to electronic bills, and just avoid the mail altogether. And then as long as it's sent to a qualified, secured email account, preferably something like on Exchange or something on Google, you should probably be pretty good. The other thing is be aware that some organizations only correspond by the mail. Taxing authorities are a great example of this. The IRS will only ever initiate something by mail with you. So if you're expecting IRS correspondence, make sure you send it to a secured mailbox and something that is checked regularly. IRS correspondence is almost always a treasure trove of really useful information for committing tax fraud and other types of identity theft. So be careful with that. And whenever possible, send it to some sort of secured mailbox, a locking mailbox, a PO box, something like that, so that you don't run the risk of somebody stealing a letter that has your social security number, your address, or maybe your AGI, and then using that to file a fraudulent tax return. Okay, merchants refuse your checks. Easy way to resolve that, don't use checks. Use credit transactions and electronic transactions whenever possible. Debt collectors call you about debts that aren't yours. Often, if you've gotten into this level of identity theft, unfortunately, you've got to have an uphill battle. If people are calling you about debt at this point, it's probably gone on for a fair amount of time. You find unfamiliar accounts or charges in your credit report. We'll talk about our credit reports here in a little bit, but you should be reviewing your credit report regularly, at least every couple of months, to ensure that there aren't new transactions being posted that you're not aware of. Or at a very minimum, you should consider putting a credit freeze, and then that way no new accounts can be added to your credit profile without you specifically allowing them. We'll talk about credit freezes here in a little bit. Another good example is when you go to e-file your tax return. So you want to submit your e-file of return. And this is very poignant. At the date of this recording, we're in late March in 2021 here. The IRS has extended the tax filing deadline to May. Some of you, unfortunately, are going to go to file your return and find out there's already been a return filed. Almost always that indicates that there has been a fraudulent tax return filed. And unfortunately, you're going to have to file some affidavits and then ultimately get that rectified with the taxing authorities. We'll talk about that here in a minute. But whenever possible, e-file as quickly as you possibly can, because that's one of the best ways to ensure that your return will not be fraudulent. Now, I'd be remiss if we didn't spend at least a few minutes talking about the role of social media with identity theft and what this means to an organization, or to an individual and an organization for that matter. Social media is a lot of things to a lot of different people. However, to identity thieves, it is one of the absolute best resources they have at their disposal, because people willingly hand off their information on these social media profiles that they can use for their hacking or malware or phishing purposes. People willingly give up what high school they attended, what their favorite concert was, what their vacation plans are. And as such, if somebody can compromise your social media, they can usually learn things about you that they will then use in phishing campaigns, spear phishing campaigns, or things like social engineering. So what I would tell you, my absolute best recommendation with respect to social media and identity theft, is avoid sharing too much. Okay. This is probably especially true for the younger generation, but hold your cards close to your chest. Don't put as much information as you think you should out there. And you need to assume that everything on your profile is public to the world, and that there are going to be people outside of your friends that are going to get access to this. And increasingly, we're seeing, for example, fake people, people you don't even know, that are asking to befriend you. You know, they're sending you a friend request and you're like, I don't know this person. Well, that might be a attacker, might be a perpetrator that's trying to gain your trust so they can see your profile and then ultimately exploit that information and ultimately use it against you. Some general best practices that I would recommend: avoid sharing your email address whenever possible, especially if it's used for login. Generally, my best practices around email is you have one email that you use for public, one email that you use for private. The public one is the one in your business card. It's the one that you correspond with people with. The private one is going to be the one that you use for logins to websites or your computer or things of this nature. You know, if somebody gets your email and it's the public one and it's not used for your bank, it's not used for your credit union, well, they're not going to be able to go anywhere with it. Avoid sharing common answers to security questions. You know, typically the stuff that we're going to post about on social media is also the stuff that we use for password reset. We call this knowledge-based authentication, and we've all done this. We'll go to sign up for an account. It'll ask us to set some password reset questions. What was your high school mascot? What was your first car? What was your mother's maiden name? Well, this is also stuff that we would commonly post about on social media. I would generally tell you not to post that information. Or if you are going to post that information, for the password reset questions that you use, ensure that you're not using that data. In my life, I've got Steve and I've got fake Steve, you know, and I will use fake information for those password reset questions that has no bearing or relation to real Steve. You know, real Steve, for example, went to Big Bear Lake High School, okay, and graduated in 1998. Okay, fake Steve went to Lake Arrowhead High School and he graduated in 96. If you were to go look at my Facebook profile, you would not see any relation to the actual question answers. It's not like they go and check this stuff. As long as you know the answer to it, it doesn't really matter what you provide there. Be careful about stuff that you post, you know, willingly. For example, quizzes often can be used to find information about you that could be then used to guess, for example, your date of birth or your home or things of this nature. Be careful installing anything that utilizes your location, or be careful about posting things like your travel plans. You know, if you post, for example, like, so excited to be in Bermuda for the next 2 weeks, well, I mean, maybe somebody's going to pay a visit to your home or maybe to your mailbox or something like that. I generally try to post, if I am going to post something like that, after the fact, so that I'm not willingly advertising my travel plans so that someone could burglarize my home or office. Now, there are a couple of specific types of identity theft that we should be aware of, and we're going to look at three. We're going to look at medical identity theft, tax identity theft, and child identity theft. Okay. Now, medical identity theft occurs when a perpetrator uses a victim's name, health insurance information, or otherwise identifying information to see a doctor, to get prescription drugs, file a health insurance claim, or something like this. Now, the stuff you need to be on the lookout for is very similar to the general signs of identity theft. You get bills for services you didn't receive. You get a debt collector about medical debt you don't owe. A notice from your health plan saying that you've reached your benefit, or denial of insurance because of a pre-existing condition. You need to treat even non-financial stuff like your health insurance with the same care and consideration that you would your social security number and your banking details. The last thing you want to deal with when you're having a medical emergency is somebody from the billing office saying, oh, Mr. Yass, you know, your insurance has been declined for such and such reason. That's not good. Okay. So we want to ensure that our medical information is free and clear so that if we have to use it, it's good to go. So be careful with your medical information and don't put it out there to anybody who should not have access to it. Now, I do want to talk a little bit more about tax identity theft because, again, we are in filing season and the IRS, in their infinite wisdom, has extended the tax season to mid-May, but not extending the estimated tax payments or any of the other major forms, just the individual. The corporate tax deadline is still the same, just the individual got moved. As such, tax theft is on the rise. It is something that we need to be specifically careful with. Because this can be a long, anywhere from a, I would say at the minimum 6 to 18 month or longer ordeal to get this worked out with the IRS. The IRS is, and most taxing authorities at the state level are horrendously backlogged. The last thing you want to have happen is tax fraud because it can take so long to get through their backlog for them to resolve your issue. Now, identity theft, when it comes and relates to taxes, almost always around receiving some sort of fraudulent refund. It's going to be around somebody files a fake return with fake income, ultimately to get a refund back. And the IRS will almost always issue the refund and they'll almost always process the return. You could have a doctor making $500,000 a year in 2020, and then file a next return, they get tax fraud, and somebody files a fraudulent return the next year, and they get the earned income credit. You know, as long as the mathematics of the return calculate almost all circumstances, the IRS will process the return and issue the refund. And they are required by law to process that refund in like 2 weeks. You know, they can't sit on that money for a very, very long time. So with tax fraud, they'll use a stolen social security number. They'll use a stolen address. They'll put in their own bank account information. They will submit a forged return and they will attempt to get that refund early in the season. You know, as soon as the tax season opens up, you know, that's usually when they're going to try to process this as quick as possible. Okay. Now you will be unaware that this issue happened until you file your return later in the season and discover because it is rejected because there's already a return been filed under the same social security number, okay? So in this particular instance, you've got to resolve this. And the way that we resolve this is going to be through filing an affidavit with the IRS. And it's specifically form 14039. You tell the IRS what happened, you give them some supporting evidence, and then they will evaluate your case and process the return correctly. But again, it can take at minimum 6 months, and that is like a unicorn type of time period. More realistically, it's going to be 1 to 2 years to get this resolved. Now, A question that often gets asked with this, are identity theft losses deductible? And the answer is kind of, okay? A lot of us itemized our deductions a lot more frequently in prior years. However, since about 2018, most of the Schedule A deductions have been reduced or eliminated, and most folks can't itemize, okay? Can you deduct your identity theft? Yes. However, it is part of the theft and casualty form, which is IRS form 4684, which is part of the Schedule A. Okay. And if you can't itemize, you're not going to be able to deduct your identity theft at the individual level. So, it's going to be subject to the same limitations that we would get with that Schedule A. And in order to be able to use this, you got to be able to itemize. If you're normally taking the standard deduction, unless you have massive identity theft losses, you're probably not going to be able to do this. Okay. Now, you can deduct identity theft losses to the extent that you're not reimbursed or compensated. If you have, for example, an insurance policy like I do, or a lot of people do for that matter, and they reimburse you, well, you can only deduct the portion that is not reimbursed. And as with anything involving casualty and theft, make sure you keep those meticulous records about what occurred in case that you do get audited. Now, in my opinion, probably the most heinous type of identity theft is the one around kids. And it's because a kid can't really help themselves. And often what happens with children is they will get their identity compromised and then the crime will go unnoticed for years. Okay. The net effect of this, you need to pay as much attention to your kid's credit profile as you do your own. So if it is, if you're doing credit monitoring, do it not only for yourself, but for your husband and wife, and then your kids. Keep an eye on that because you could be saddling them with some sort of issue that you might not know about for 5, 6, 7 years. And then all of a sudden they go to college or they go to get a job and now they find out about it. And then it will take often an extremely long time to resolve. Now, children are the fastest growing segment of identity theft victims. There's about 500,000 cases of identity theft with kids every year. And why do criminals like them? Well, often they will have a clean credit profile unless mom and dad started borrowing on their kids' profile, which does occur from time to time. Most kids will have clean credit profiles. And so it's going to be easy for the criminal to create new accounts. Now, often what these criminals will do is they will find a kid, they will compromise the kid's identity, they will open up credit cards, they'll even properly pay those credit cards for a period of time, trying to build credit. Once it gets to a position where it looks good, they'll open up a bunch of credit cards, a bunch of accounts, wreck the kid's credit, and it can go on again, like I said, for several years. So, one of three things will usually occur when that identity theft for that child will arise. Kid goes to get a job and starts paying taxes and you start getting letters from the IRS. Kid goes to the DMV to get a driver's license and is rejected because of a criminal profile. Or they go to college and they go to apply for student loans and they're rejected due to a poor credit profile. Those are your three main ways where identity theft can be uncovered. So, with the risk to kids, it can go on for a long period of time. We need to be a little bit more cognizant of some of the specific data for our children, in the same way that we would be cognizant of our own and protect it in the same way that we would do for our own. So for kids stuff, here's some ideas: hospital records, physician's office, you know, keep track of their medical data, you know, from the point of birth all the way through their childhood and teens and beyond. Be careful with school records. You know, have a conversation with the principal, have a conversation with the parent, other parents and the teachers. Hey, where are you storing my kids' records? How are they being stored? Who has access to them? How long are they being retained for? Likewise with anything that kid might come in contact with, things like daycare providers or even things like sports teams. You know, often you're going to sign your kid up for something like ASO or Little League or Boy Scouts or something like that. Okay, that's great. Often they're being run by volunteers. There'll be some sort of application you'll sign your kid up for. I would ask that person, well, where's this application going? Who has it? How long is it retained for? How is it disposed of? You know, if it's just going over to Susie's house and it's just going to stay there for 30 years, you know, because Susie never cleaned out her records, well, that's not appropriate. You want to make sure that if this application of whatever type has medical information, social security information, that it is disposed of whenever your kid is done. Now, increasingly, children themselves are falling victim to this due to their own actions. Increasingly, kids are getting on social media younger and younger ages. The discussion that we had a little bit ago with respect to your social media recommendations, you know, about not sharing, oversharing, and not answering common security questions, things of this nature, this conversation is something you should absolutely have with your child when they join social media. And they need to be aware of there are bad people in this world that will use their information against them. Alrighty, so let's go ahead and have our second review question. Which of the following is not a common sign of identity theft? Okay, you don't get your bills or other mail. Nope, that is definitely a sign. Doesn't mean it always is, but it's definitely one of the conditions. You find unfamiliar accounts or charges on your credit profile. Nope, that's a pretty good indication too. Debt collectors calling you about debts that aren't yours. Again, also pretty common. You receive unsolicited physical mail or emails from unknown senders. That's probably the correct answer here. And that doesn't mean if you start getting mail from people you don't know or you get email from people you don't know, that doesn't always mean identity theft. That would not immediately set off my spidey sense for identity theft, but it would be something that I might want to look into. I personally am very adamant about unsubscribing and filling out the do not sell my information forms. And I'd recommend that you do it too. Typically unsolicited stuff is more spam than it is related to identity theft. Okay, so for our last about 15 minutes or so here, let's talk about resources that are available if you fall victim to identity theft, some things that you would want to consider. Okay, now if you suspect identity theft, I've got a triage list of things here that you should consider doing. First and foremost, change your email password. We'll talk about this in our data breach course, but often if I can compromise your email, I can compromise everything about you. And the reason being is almost everything comes back to email. It's your, you know, digital trapper keeper for your life. And if you can compromise somebody's email, you actually don't need to compromise anything else. If I know your email, for example, I can go and change your password on all the different sites that you happen to be using. You're definitely going to want to change all your major passwords, banking, Amazon, Facebook, social media, things of this nature, your major stuff, likewise your major PIN codes. If it's financial, you might want to call your bank, your credit cards. You might want to cancel them or at least let them know that there might be fraud and they can pause charges for a duration of time. Often with identity theft, it's about triage. It's about kind of limiting our risk with respect to the damage that has occurred and stopping further damage from occurring. You might want to put together a recovery plan. We'll talk about that here in a minute. Absolutely, you're going to want to keep meticulous records about when things occur, how they occurred, where they occurred. And if you believe identity theft occurred, you're going to want to gather that evidence and then ultimately consider filing a police report. Let's talk a little bit about your credit file, because identity theft and credit really go hand in hand with each other, and understanding how these are used and how the profile is being used and where they will use it will be really helpful either for resolution or ideally preventative measures that would occur to you. Okay. Now, if you suspect identity theft has occurred, you can do a thing called a fraud alert. Okay. A fraud alert is an alert that you notify with Equifax, TransUnion, or Experian. You say, hey, something occurred here. I'm not 100% sure. And they're going to put extra effort around notifying when potential new accounts are opened in your name. Okay. We also have a credit freeze as well. We're going to talk more about both of these terms here just in a second, but you can do one, you can do the other, you can do one ahead of time for that matter. You can also get your free credit reports from annualcreditreport.com. We'll talk about that here in a minute as well. Okay. You can also create an identity theft report. There are multiple different agencies and groups that will take this report. Here in the United States, the most common organization is the Federal Trade Commission, and they've got a complaint center. And if you happen to be one of our friends from the North, the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center also will take a report from you. And again, always keeping meticulous records and following up when we find out about this information and we find out about these crimes. So we have a freeze and we also have a lock. What are they? Okay. Well, A fraud alert is something you hope to never have to do. Okay, a fraud alert basically is an alert sent to Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian, and it says, hey, fraud might have occurred. And it requires a business to verify the consumer's credit that they actually are the actual person before extending new credit. And so this prevents a bank or a credit card company from either extending a credit line or opening a new credit card in your name. Now, with a fraud alert, you only need to notify one of these agencies. So you can call Equifax, you can call Experian, you can call TransUnion, but only call one. The law requires the other agencies to notify each other. So you only have to call one. Now, in my opinion, a better preventative measure is a credit freeze. Okay? A credit freeze means no one, not even me, the consumer, can access my credit report to open a new account. So you can do this right now. You can go freeze your credit, but you have to do it with each one of them. So you have to call Equifax, TransUnion, Experian. You can either call them or go on their website and create a profile and do it that way. And when you freeze it, whatever credit you have now, so your existing credit cards, your existing bank, your existing mortgage, whatever, they're going to continue to operate, but it will not allow a new account to be accessed or an inquiry to be able to access unless you unfreeze your credit. So it's going to prevent anybody new from being able to open up anything. And in my opinion, this is probably one of the easiest ways to reduce your risk and exposure. So if the consumer puts it on there, they get a PIN, and then anytime they want to unfreeze it or refreeze it, they use that PIN, and it will temporarily or permanently, you can say, hey, unfreeze it for 3 days, unfreeze it for a week. If you're going through a refi, for example, you know, you might need to unfreeze it for a period of time just to allow the refi paperwork to go through. And again, existing creditors will continue to have access to it. Now, we also have this other term, credit lock. Credit lock doesn't really mean anything. You know, it's a marketing term. It usually means a credit freeze, but not necessarily. Remember, the credit freezes only can come from the agencies, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian. And if you want to freeze your credit, which I would recommend you do, you have to do it with those agencies. No other company can do it for you. Or if they do, they're going to charge you. You can do this for free. As of 2018, by law, credit freezes became free for everybody, and alerts will last a year rather than 90 days. So there is never a need to pay for this service. Now, with respect to your credit profile, it's super easy to do. Your credit profile is a statement that has information about your credit activity, including your credit situation, your current loans, and has all the statuses of your existing account. Okay? You can get this for free, and I'll talk about that here in a minute. But if you suspect fraud has occurred, you want to get your credit report and you want to review all the information on here, regardless of how inconsequential, you know, $5, $10, a $500 credit limit for one credit card, whatever. What you're ultimately looking for is stuff that you did not participate in or was done by some sort of third party. You're looking for the stuff that does not relate to you. Okay. Now, if you find errors or fraud, you have to write a letter and you will notify the vendor, the credit card company, so on and so forth. Hey, this isn't right. This didn't occur. This is not me. And then they are required by law to investigate all these claims and they have to send you a written reply. And they might request more information. They might agree with you. Okay. Regardless, though, it is your opportunity and obligation to be able to follow up to ensure that the records are collected. And often it might require several letters before that credit is accepted, before whatever your adjustment asking is accepted. Now, here in the United States, federal law does require that you can get a copy of your credit report for free. Okay. This is through a company called annualcreditreport.com. And I'm specifically mentioning them because they are the only federally authorized credit reporting agency that can pull this for you from Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian for free. Any other website, any other service that portrays this is fraudulent. Annual Credit Report is going to be that one that will pull that credit for you. Now, there are other services, for example, like Credit Karma. It's an app that you can pull your credit. Okay, great. You can use that. It's owned by Intuit. It's a reputable product. But just be aware that yes, you might be getting your credit profile, but you're also opting in to receive a ton of marketing, correspondence, and other stuff with it. You can get your credit profile for free and your report for free by going to annualcreditreport.com, filling out the form, and then you can get it. This is a great way of keeping an eye on your credit history. Okay, it's recommended you rotate your credit reports from these different companies. That way you're regularly reviewing everything from one agency, you know? So maybe in December, January, you pull your Equifax report. April, May, you pull your TransUnion report. September, October, you pull your Experian report. And that way you're regularly reviewing these things from the perspective of each of these companies. And if this does fall victim to it, well, guess what? At least you have some idea in a reasonable amount of time to be able to do something. Where identity theft can be really detrimental is when it goes on for months, years, things of this nature. Okay. Maybe you want to consider identity theft protection service. I'll mention that here at the end of our presentation. Now, additionally, our federal government has a ton of free resources that you can utilize to help you if you become a victim of identity theft. Okay, they've got tons of stuff, including a tool that will help build you a recovery plan. They've got sample letters that could be used to send to your creditors or bank and other companies. And all of it is accessible through the website identitytheft.gov. Let's take a look at that real quick. So here's identitytheft.gov. And from here, you can go ahead and you can start a recovery plan. And it's got this little WYSIWYG tool that will guide you through asking questions about what you did and how you did it. You know, for example, somebody used my information for unemployment service. Somebody filed a tax return. My data was exposed in a breach, so on and so forth. Let's go ahead and choose this top one here because unemployment benefits are on the rise. And we can kind of read through here and it'll give us some great recommendations and steps in terms of what we would want to do, as well as the links to the different credit reporting bureaus and so on and so forth that we might choose to use. Okay. And it'll even create for you a customized plan with sample letters and other things that you might choose to use to help resolve this. And you could tell it, for example, credit cards, telephone, employment, whatever it ends up being, it will generate some of the specific terminology and letters and things that you might need to follow up with these people, ultimately giving you a very, very nice comprehensive plan that you can then use to follow to hopefully be able to resolve your identity theft issues. Now, the Federal Trade Commission also has a number of other fantastic, great resources that are available, especially if you are a practitioner. You might want to consider these resources. They have, or if you're like an HR or something like that, because what you can use these resources is to educate yourself. You can use this to educate the public. You can use it to educate your clients, whomever. Okay. They've got things like bookmarks, brochures, identity theft guides, materials. Okay. They've got them in several different languages, including English, Chinese, Spanish, and they will even ship these materials for free to you anywhere in the United States. And if you don't want physical materials, you can download them if you prefer something electronically. So we can get to this website by going to bulkorder.ftc.gov, and you could see they've got all these fantastic resources. Here's one of my favorites, Identity Theft, What to Know and What to Do. Okay. If we wanted to download a digital version of this, we can, and we could even order copies of this. And we would just put in our information, and we would essentially tell us, you know, where we'd like it shipped, and they will ship them to us for free. It might take a little bit of time, but you would end up with a really kind of cool book. And here's an example. This is the digital version of this, where you can learn what this is. And so if I was a practitioner, for example, I might have this in my office. I might distribute it to my clients when they come to pick up their returns. Or if I was an HR for a company, I might have this on my break room or in, you know, where I keep my employee information. Now, there are a variety of other resources that are available to you. I've got a listing of some here. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go through these, but I've got a number of resources from other U.S. government and Canadian government agencies, including the United States Secret Service, the Postal Inspector, the SEC, the IRS. Depending on the nature of the identity theft that occurs to you, just realize there's probably an agency that can go and help you resolve this. Now, the last thing I want to mention would be identity theft protection. This is something you can consider doing, Okay. Identity Theft Protection is a company service that will continuously monitor your credit profile, notifying you about any changes that might occur. It's essentially a watchdog that's always there, keeping an eye out for you, and they'll send you an email or a text notification if, for example, they see a new account being opened in your name. Okay. This isn't mandatory by any means, but it's a nice to have thing if this is something you're concerned about. And it's a great way to be able to also build your credit profile, understand your credit profile. And if you do fall victim to identity theft, they often have a number of resources available to you to help resolve it. There's a lot of great providers to consider, but I've got a couple in particular. If you're a member of Costco, they've got their own program through one of the major credit bureaus as well. If you're looking for something independent, Identity Card has always had a very strong reputation, as well as a company called ID Shield. However, please do your own due diligence and research when choosing a provider. The only provider I don't recommend is LifeLock. They've always had a very interesting and troubled past where they've gotten people where they've had very misleading advertising and marketing materials. And so they don't really have a great reputation, nor do they really have a strong technology base that I think some of these other companies do have. So if you're going to buy this, buy the best, check out these three. And of course, maybe reach out to your local bank, credit union, wherever you happen to keep your money. They might have a recommendation or a service provider that you could work with as well. Well, that does bring us to the end of our podcast for the day. Let's go ahead and have our final review question. Okay. So, where can you get a free copy of your credit report? Okay. Is it going to be Experian? No, they do not give that to you. Is it Equifax? No, they don't give it to you either. TransUnion? No. Okay. The correct answer here is going to be Annual Credit Report. Okay. That company pulls it from those three. So you don't need to go to those three. You just go there and it will get you all three. One of the three, two of the three, whatever you choose to use. And my personal recommendation would be that you would rotate between them. So what did we discuss today? Well, today we did an introduction to identity theft and data breaches, defining those words and what they mean. Then we took a deep dive into discussing some of the common types of identity theft. We also discussed tons of different recommendations on how to reduce your risk and exposure for general identity theft or medical identity theft or kid identity theft. Hopefully you've come away with different things that you can do to help reduce your exposure in those specific types. And we also discussed some different methods for dealing with and hopefully resolving that ID theft if you do become a victim. And I very much hope you do not. Now, future courses in this series, we're going to take a deep dive on organizational data breaches. We're going to look at how they occur and how we can reduce our risk and exposure. And we're also going to discuss tons of best practices, both at the individual and organizational level. Now, I do want to remind you, if you are a certified accountant, if you are a EA, if you're a CPA, if you're some sort of professional that requires continuing education as a manner of keeping your license, good news, you are in luck. You can earn a CPE credit just by listening to today's podcast and then taking a short quiz. It's super simple. Again, check out cpetoday.com. Use course code IDT1. Take a quick exam and you will earn a credit for today's class and you will be on your way to maintaining your license. Again, check out cpetoday.com and use course code IDT1. As always, it is a pleasure presenting this information to you. I would recommend and welcome you to connect with us on social media. You can find us on most social medias, including YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and others at CPE Today. We'd love for you to leave a comment or a review. And if you're listening after the fact, you can always stream us on demand on the streaming platform of your choice. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, SoundClouds, and others. We would love it if you would subscribe to our podcast so that you get the latest updates and the latest episodes as they are released. And if you get a second, love for you to leave us a comment or review if you like our content. Every little bit helps. It is a pleasure being with you here today. Thank you so much for your time and attention, and I very much look forward to seeing you in another podcast soon. Stay safe. See you soon.